Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
Are you reeling in the yeast? Stowing away the time. Are you gathering up the tea? Have you had enough of mine?
We're back. It's 12 after. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. Thank you very much for joining us today. It's my pleasure to be part of your day. And ladies and gentlemen, I feel very honored today to introduce you to our guest. He's a friend of mine that I consider to be a blessing that he is a friend of mine. His name is Austin Kiplinger. I've been telling you about him, his impending visit, for a long time now. He is the chairman of the Kiplinger Washington Editors. He's editor emeritus of the Kiplinger Washington Letter. There's so many things I want to tell you about him, but we don't have that much time. But I do want to say that he started his full-time reporting career in 1940. He served in World War II as an aviator in the South Pacific. He helped launch the Changing Times magazine, which is now the Kiplinger personal finance magazine. And his father founded Kiplinger. And there are two things that we're celebrating this week. One is the 81st anniversary of the Kiplinger letter and his 86th birthday. Mr. Kiplinger, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Jim. It's good to be here.
Well, it's great to have you back. And happy birthday first on spending 86 years on this earth. And I'll tell you, it's just it's great to have you here today.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here. For a variety of reasons.
and also, congratulations on 81 years with the Kiplinger letter. How about that?
Well, that's right. I can't say that I remember the first day, but I was in the office very shortly thereafter.
You were roaming around there at that time anyway, weren't you?
I was. As a matter of fact, I hung out the window of the office looking at the parade in 1925 when Calvin Coolidge was inaugurated. Now, how's that for history?
That's history. And, folks, that's the reason why you've heard me say that this man is a witness to the century, to a century. He certainly is. Mr. Kiplinger, I want to talk about some of the things that you have seen, and I want you to compare some of the things that are going on. And we're going to use a little bit of the letter as well, to the letter this week, to talk about some of these things. Some of the things that are going on today, and compare them to in your perspective, to some of the historical things that you've seen. First thing I'd like to talk about a little bit is politics. Tell us your thoughts on, I'd like your thoughts on the way the political environment is today compared to the way you have seen it in the past.
Well, we have a tendency, I think everyone does, to think that politics have, the standards have declined and have gotten more rough and more combative and more negative. But I'm not sure that's true. I think if you look at underneath the surface of American history, you find a great deal of ferocity and rough and tumble. What has changed, of course, is that we transmit this almost instantaneously to the entire nation, and for that matter to the world. Mm-hmm. And our communications have become so much more instant that we all reverberate to it right away. You know, we had in politics between the parties, we say that this is the most partisan time in our history. I don't think that is true. In my years as a reporter, I remember the days of the Depression and the bitter fights between unions and business corporations, and the bitter antagonism between the Republican and Democratic administrations in Franklin Roosevelt's day. And then we had the Joseph McCarthy era, when people almost couldn't get into the same room together without getting into a fight. And when I say fight, I mean almost literally.
Yeah.
Fist fights. So I think that there's always a tendency to think that our standards are declining. Now, they do take some dips and some rises from time to time, and in terms of corporate responsibility, we had a terrible time there in the 90s when a lot of corporate officials, especially in the new high-tech industries, just lost their sense of balance.
Right.
There's no question about that.
They suspended suspended some of the laws of economics and ethics.
And common decency.
Yes.
You know, my grandparents who helped to raise me instilled in me the idea that your morals and your ethics are the same at the office as they are at home.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather was a carriage builder, and he believed in giving value for the money. In fact, when he became a house builder, I think sometimes he gave more value than he did for the money, so he didn't stay in the business.
He was too good to his customers. One of the things, Mr. Kiplinger, that I'd like to say, though, that is different today than, and I really appreciate your perspective on this, and I appreciate your, and of course, we can also remind ourselves that you know, a couple of hundred years ago, two of the top four people in our nation's political leadership had a duel, and one of them was killed.
That is true.
I mean, that was pretty serious in those days. But I guess the thing that is different today is that we seem to have that kind of antagonism that you talked about that was going on in the 40s and that we know have gone on in the history of our country. We seem to have that in our face 24/7 now, and I think that's
exactly the right thing. That is correct. If you look at the effect of the Vietnam War and now the Iraq War, we have headlines in the newspaper in the right-hand column every morning on if one soldier is killed.
Right.
Well, I was in World War II, and I don't want to make it more heroic than it was, but you know, we lost a lot of men. We lost them off the ship. We lost them in the air. We lost them in crashes. And they weren't front page news every time one of my squadron mates bit the dust or went to the bottom of the sea. We have this instantly, right in our face at dinner time.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a major difference.
Yep. And do you think that's a bad thing?
Well, it's just inevitable. I don't try to gauge history by good and bad. I think that's one of the attributes of our kind of reporting. We try to call it as it is, as we see it, as realistically as possible, without any kind of partisan bias.
Right.
And we try to leave it to each person to make up his own mind whether he thinks it's good or bad.
Mr. Kiplinger,
sound like a very high-level kind of reporting, but I think it's fundamental to democracy that you lay out the facts as well as you can, and you let each individual voter, every individual person, make up his own mind whether he likes it.
Mr. Kiplinger, stand by. 20 after, folks, we'll be right back. I told you you'd enjoy this interview. Stay with us.
Celebrating 6 years is radio's small business superhero. He's a syndicated radio host, syndicated columnist, author of two books, and all-around nice guy.
He's everywhere! He's everywhere!
The most fantastic crime fighter the world has ever known.
He's Jim Blassingame, the small business advocate.
We're back. It's 23 after. Thanks for hanging around with us. Mr. Austin Kiplinger is our guest, ladies and gentlemen. He is a graduate. He's a Phi Beta Kappa graduate from Cornell University. And I know, Mr. Kiplinger, you still have ties to that, don't you? Cornell University.
I do. I was on the board for many years, and I'm chairman emeritus now.
Right. Yeah, chairman emeritus. How about that? That's a great story. And I know you guys are doing good things all over the world.
You know what emeritus means, Jim?
No, sir.
Well, it comes from Latin.
I think I do, but you can tell us.
Well, X means you're out, and meritus means you deserve to be.
that sounds like me. I went to I helped the SBA, as you know, quite a bit, and I went to one of their big soirees, and they gave me a VIP badge.
Yes.
And somebody came up to me, and they were teasing me. A friend of mine said, "What does that mean?" I said, "It means work for free."
That's exactly right.
Okay, let's get back to our discussion and talk about, we were talking about politics. Let's talk about politicians. And one of the things I want to ask you about the politicians you gave us a pretty good grounding in the, how, what's different about politics these days. And thank you for helping us because with that, because sometimes I think we get the idea that things are a lot worse than they used to be. And you've kind of helped us to understand that maybe they're not. Maybe it's just that we've got it in our face so much. But how about politicians? Do you think that leadership has become as scarce a commodity as it seems like it has?
Well, I think I have perhaps a little different view on that from the common perception, because I believe that politics reflects the electorate quite accurately. And we do go through periods of great emotional strain, and then we get into periods of calm. And our politics reflects that. I think that the Congress pretty accurately reflects the electorate. Now, we don't always like that, because when our politicians don't show up very well, we think that they're a separate breed, and we blame all of our problems on them, like the scapegoat. Send him out into the desert. Mm-hmm. But I believe that it reflects pretty closely the attitudes of the public. And I think, right, another point of view that I think is not exactly the standard garden variety point of view, and that is that I don't think we are as sharply divided today as we have been at times past, and I can give you some examples. We're divided almost 50-50 in the Congress. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that there's a great middle ground that is not reflected by the political partisanship. I think in social policy that people are much closer to the middle, and I don't think the parties necessarily reflect that.
Yeah.
I think that most people would like sort of a mixture of the parties. We who are interested in business and production and economics, we tend to think that government hands off is a good idea. But when it comes to some things as environment and health and social policy, we tend to think government ought to get into it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a great mixture. I think it's going through a turmoil right now, and I think in the next 5 to 10 years we're going to have some new alignments emerging from it.
Are you hopeful that we can instill leadership and ethics? And maybe I shouldn't say ethics, although I'd like to think that we probably need to improve that in our politicians as well, in our political process as well. But are you hopeful that leadership can once again be seen as something as valuable and as important? Is it possible to have that in the future, you think?
Well, the times create the situation in politics. I think it's, maybe I have a backwards view of it, but I think people rise and fall in accordance to the challenge. And when the challenge gets great enough, we pull up our standards and we face it. You know, World War II is a fairly good example. We like to think that we were the heroes of World War II and we saved the world from Hitler, but we didn't get into it until we were socked in the face.
Mm-hmm.
And I happen to have been then an interventionist. That was a dirty word at that time. I thought we belonged in the war.
Yeah.
I thought we should be going after Hitler. I thought he was an evil force in the world, and we should have gotten in a lot sooner. But we didn't get in 1939. We didn't get in when Hitler invaded Western Europe. We didn't get in until we were attacked.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we rise to the occasion. But I think that's the nature of democracy. We don't act too far in advance, and we don't all even act when the danger is right in our face. We act when we're socked in the face.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know whether that's good or bad, but I think that's the fact of the matter.
Well, one of the things that concerns me when I talk about leadership, when I say leadership in politics, I'm talking about parties that hold the party line even when they know that the person that they're holding the line for is wrong. I mean, nothing.
Yes.
That's a lack of leadership.
Is, and it's awfully hard to break from the fold. It's just a human tendency to want to stay with your family, stay with your clan,
mm-hmm.
stay with your tribe.
But
it's
still
awfully hard to be out there by yourself.
but still, it, you know, it's not the right thing to do. And that's the problem. That's where we have the breach of leadership, as far as I'm concerned. Mr. Kiplinger, stand by. We're going to take a quick break. Folks, we're visiting with Mr. Austin Kiplinger, the editor emeritus of the Kiplinger Editors. And when we come back, I'm going to ask him to tell us a little bit about how this piece, how this great document, the Kiplinger
letter. Happy anniversary, baby. Got you on my mind. Happy anniversary, baby. Got you on my mind.
We're back. It's 34 After. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. And once again, Mr. Kiplinger, Mr. Austin Kiplinger, ladies and gentlemen, is our guest. Mr. Kiplinger, happy anniversary on 81 years of the Kiplinger Letters.
Thank you very much, Jim.
And by the way, folks, I'll remind you, Mr. Kiplinger, I know you were with me when we did this 6 years ago. Mr. Kiplinger joined me to celebrate their 75th anniversary. A year ago, I was in your offices celebrating your 80th anniversary, broadcasting from your offices. And so this is our third anniversary together.
Well, we're making a habit of it, and I like it.
I do, too. We're going to have to keep doing this.
Let's keep it going.
I want you to tell us about the founding of the Kiplinger Letters. What is your – I know you were a little munchkin in those days.
I was a small shaver.
But I know you witnessed a lot of the early years, and your dad told you about it. Tell us about the founding of the Kiplinger Letter.
Well, Jim, it grew step by step. As we generally tend to start things in our organization in response to a need. And I'll tell you how it started. My father was a reporter in Ohio, and he was with the Associated Press, and he came to Washington during World War I, covered the Treasury. And that wasn't considered a very glamorous beat in those days because the White House, of course, was the top beat. And my father did a little of that, too. But he learned that there was a lot of interesting and very important business going on at the Treasury that affected us all. And then when the war was over, he became a correspondent, a news correspondent for a New York bank, the National Bank of Commerce. And he wrote them a weekly report. And up in New York, they called it the Kiplinger Letter from Washington. And it wasn't high flown. It was down to earth, practical business material, the kind of things that everybody needed, but they didn't think they did, and they weren't getting it very much. Mm-hmm. Well, then when there was a little recession after World War I, and they decided to kind of downsize the Washington News office, my father started his own office, and he was doing queries. He would find information for people. They might need to know about exporting products or about tax laws or something of that kind. And he did that for about 3 years, and he started the letter in 1923.
September 29th. In fact, I have a copy of the original letter. Folks, it was on one sheet of paper, front and back.
It started on one side.
It's written like a letter.
Exactly, and it still is. We've made a few little style changes, but you have to, you know, to accommodate the style of today.
Well, you've added now it's four pages, two sheets,
right,
front and back. And
but we still write it to somebody.
Right.
If we don't just distribute it out into the wind and let it be blown wherever it goes. We write it to somebody at the other end. My father used to have a favorite cousin in Ohio, and he would mentally rewriting to him. And it's a good exercise. I do it, too, and right. I think my son does.
Well,
gone through three editorships, Jim. My father wrote it personally and then personally supervised it and took responsibility until he turned it over to me in 1961. That was, 43 years ago. And I did that the same way until I turned it over to my son, Knight, about 10 years ago.
Right.
And we take personal responsibility and we sign it.
Yeah, every letter has yours or Knight's signature on it.
That's right.
Yeah,
and we may be right, we may be wrong, but we're not motivated to. We're not biased. We try to tell you what we think the real outcome will be, whether you like it or whether we like it. It doesn't matter.
Well, it's a great publication, and of course, most folks know about it. I've been reading it for a long time. It's written in snippets. Didn't you tell me that that's what your dad called it?
Well, we called it sweep line, because the idea was that your eye goes across the line, and you can absorb that, and then it goes across another line, and you absorb that, and we don't hook them together. We don't break the line or the thought. We try to make it a single thought. That's kind of an ideal, and we may not always achieve it, but that's what we aim for.
Right. Mr. Kiplinger, we're going to take a quick break, folks, and when we come back, one of the things I want to ask Mr. Kiplinger, we're going to get back into some issues, some current event issues, because I want Mr. Kiplinger to give us his perspective on that. But I do want to ask him to tell us about the early entrepreneurial days of the Kiplinger Letter, how his dad dealt with those, which are some of the things that you and I are dealing with right now in our small businesses. It's 2012. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. We're visiting with Austin Kiplinger, the editor emeritus of the Kiplinger Editors. We're back at 17 till. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and I'm still excited about, ladies and gentlemen, we still have Mr. Austin Kiplinger on the show. We're continuing our visit with him. He's the chairman of the Kiplinger Washington Editors, the editor emeritus of the Kiplinger Letter. We're celebrating this month the 81st birthday of the Kiplinger Letter and Mr. Kiplinger's 86th birthday. And so we really appreciate you spending some time with us today, Mr. Kiplinger. Before we go any further, I want to make sure that folks know how they can subscribe. And I know that that you can do it online by going to their website, which is kiplinger.com, K-I-P-L-I-N-G-E-R. And they have four letters. The flagship is the one we're celebrating the anniversary today, and that's the Kiplinger Letter. Every week it comes out. And then three biweekly letters, the tax letter, the California letter, the agriculture letter, and then the current generation of the magazine that you founded in the late 40s, Mr. Kiplinger.
That's right. In 1947, we had our first issue.
Of the Changing Times.
Of Changing Times, the Kiplinger magazine, and now we call it Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. That
right.
seems to be the catchphrase.
Wasn't that the document, the publication that your dad kind of brought you back into the company after you'd been out to come back into it to start?
That's right. It was immediately after the war. I'd been flying in the Navy out in the Pacific. I began to get letters from him that he had some ideas that he wanted to develop after the war. I intended to get back into newspapering. I thought I would go to Chicago and get on the Chicago Daily News, but instead I became the managing editor and executive editor of a new magazine that didn't exist.
But
that's a questionable professional outlook, but it worked out all right.
Do you happen to have the toll-free number that people can subscribe in front of you? Do you have it handy?
I don't have it handy.
Okay,
Jim,
I don't either, and I ought to know that by now. But anyway, folks, you can go to their website, and they also have a 30-day free trial, and I encourage you to check out and take advantage of that 30-day free trial on any of their publications. Mr. Kiplinger, I wanted you to talk to us about the early days of Kiplinger. And, you know, a lot of my audience, a lot of the folks listening to us right now they're small business owners, most of them. They're in various stages of the development of their business, from a dream to a mature company. And I know they'd love to hear about some of the very early challenges and opportunities that the Kiplinger Letter had.
Well, I'm glad you raised that, Jim, because it was not an instant success. I mean, it was a success, but it didn't support itself for probably nearly 10 years. But my father wanted to continue to build it.
He believed in that vision, didn't he?
Well, he knew it was useful, but, you know, the times in the 20s, Washington was not the influence that it subsequently became.
Right.
And but he knew that it was valuable because he corresponded for banks and for businesses, and they used to ask questions about things in Washington, practical questions. And he knew that it would be valuable, so he did a lot of work for other publications on the side just to support this new idea that he had and to keep it growing and keep promoting it. He worked for, he did some reporting for the New York Times on the business side. He worked for a magazine called World's Work, which has since disappeared. He worked for Nation's Business, and he did some reporting for a variety of other businesses and corporations and publications. He really worked himself night and day to make this a success, and I think that's, there is a moral in that, because instant success is not always in the cards.
Well, and it's not all, and believe it or not, folks, it's not always a good thing. But you know, Mr. Kiplinger, as you talk about some of these things that your dad endured, we recognize that. We're living that. Either we are living it or we have lived that.
Well, I think it's worthwhile to say that if you think your idea is good and you think it's useful, I mean, that's the key to it. Everything we do has got to be of use to somebody else. We're really not working for ourselves. We're working for somebody else, and then they pay us, and we exchange. And it's a fair exchange, but if you don't have an idea that you think is useful to somebody else, it probably won't succeed. It probably won't survive.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing some of those thoughts, and I had forgotten. I think you told me once before, but I had forgotten that you said that it took 10 years
yes.
for the Kiplinger letter to become self-sustaining.
It was the turnaround in the impact of government. You know, during the Depression years, government suddenly, in 1933, when Roosevelt came in, Roosevelt wasn't popular with the business community, but it was, government had an impact, an instant impact, and you really couldn't do business without knowing what was going on here, and that's when we began to take off.
I want to change subjects now and talk a little bit about globalization. We hear a lot about this. Some people, for some people, it's the enemy. It's the devil. They hate globalization. I consider globalization to be the trade manifestation of the growth of our intellect.
I think it's right, and I think it's inevitable, and I think we just have to adjust to it. You know, change is necessary, and it's inevitable in human life. The real measure of whether we adapt to it well or not is how fast we can change. I think it's difficult if we try to change too fast, because people are habit-forming. You know, we form our habits, and we don't give them up very easily. And if we don't try to change it too fast, but continue to change and keep going in that direction, then we can make the adjustment that's necessary. But, you know, globalization is inevitable. Let me tell you, in the
hold
early
on to
days,
that, Mr. Kiplinger, hold on to that thought. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, I'll let you finish that story. We'll do that right after these messages. 10 till. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. We're visiting with Mr. Austin Kiplinger, a witness to a century.
Stand by me.
We're back. 7 till. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, having more fun than the law allows. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for being part of our day. And Mr. Austin Kiplinger, ladies and gentlemen, is our guest. And Mr. Kiplinger, what a great visit we've had already. We still got more to come, but I just want to thank you again. And I want to remind folks, you know, folks, I told you that Mr. Kiplinger could do the nightly news on any network tonight if they would let him do it. But I want to point out that he was a Chicago newscaster for ABC and NBC television back in the 50s. And he was part of the ABC team that covered the 1952 political convention in Chicago on television. And when I talk about Mr. Kiplinger being a witness to a century, that's now you know what I'm talking about. Mr. Kiplinger, I wanted you to finish your story about global. You had another thought about globalization.
Well, I was thinking this, and this is in long-term historic perspective. But you know, we've been globalizing a little at a time for a long while. The United States took a lot of businesses from Europe, and after World War One, we took the chemistry industry, the chemical industry from Germany, and we took the textile business, and now the textile business is going to Asia. For a lot of the same reasons that we got it from Europe. So it's been going on endlessly, almost since the beginning of time.
Mm-hmm.
I like to say that civilization travels on the stream of commerce, and government comes along later.
Right. That's
you know,
exactly
you go
right.
around the Mediterranean back in Roman and Greek times. You know, how were all those cities established? They were established by traders. And then after the traders got there, the governments came in and took over.
And that's because our intellect is what drives our trade, and it helps us develop. We're always figuring out new ways to trade. And one of the reasons why I think globalization is not a bad thing, Mr. Kiplinger, is because I believe in something that I say all the time on this show. It's a quote from Frederick Bastiat, the great French economist. He said, when goods cross borders, armies don't.
You're correct. And, you know, we had that situation in South Africa during the apartheid region. A lot of the young idealists said that the United States ought to divorce itself from South Africa and pull out because it was still a white supremacy union. And I said quite the opposite. We ought to stay there because we ought to give them a good example of how to do it.
Right.
And I think it worked out that way.
One of the things that I say about this, based on what you were saying about how things haven't really changed, I called NAFTA, that we know as NAFTA, the third NAFTA. The first NAFTA was when the jobs came from England to New England. The second NAFTA was when they went from New England to the South, the textile jobs. The third NAFTA was what happened to the jobs that went to Mexico. And there's actually a fourth NAFTA. Those jobs that went to Mexico from America 10 years ago, they're not in Mexico anymore. They've already gone somewhere else.
They've gone to Indonesia or China or someplace like that.
It's never going to stop, ladies and gentlemen. It's one of the things we're going to – it's not that NAFTA is bad. It's that it's in a lot of ways it's good. We just have to make the adjustments.
I got a key for you, Jim.
Okay, go ahead.
Follow pineapple. We used to grow pineapple in Florida, then it went to Cuba, then it went to Hawaii, and now it's good. Now it's gone to Southeast Asia.
Same thing. I want you to talk to us about, we got about a minute and a half. Talk to us about what do you think about being an American in the 21st century?
Well, without being too maudlin about it, I think we really are a model for the world, and I hope that's not understood or misunderstood, but I think we are a government of laws and rules, and we can absorb cultures and tribes and clans and different points of view and different ways of life. And we don't have to dictate what you want to do and how you want to do it, so long as you respect the other man and give as much as you get. I think it's a rule of government. We're not a religion. We can satisfy and tolerate and absorb all religions, so long as they're true religions and not being used as an excuse for our own personal service. You know, some of these Muslim extremists are misusing religion. They're not religious.
Right.
They're sacrilegious.
That's right.
They're justifying their own personal atrocities by calling it religion. It isn't religion.
That's right. And, Mr. Kiplinger, I've got to stop you because we've run out of time, unfortunately. But before I go, happy 81st anniversary of the Kiplinger Letters. Happy 86th birthday. I'm so proud to say that you're my friend.
Thank you, Jim. It's been good to be with you.
Thank you, sir. We'll see you. We're going to see you next year on the 82nd anniversary.
It's a date.
There you go. Got to go for this hour, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you had as much fun as I did. I'm Jim Blassingame. I'll see you later.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blassingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.